Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addis, will be joining you with James Corbett of the Corbett Report for the second and third segment of the program today. And today is Thursday, January 7th, 2016, and it's great to be here today. And it is hard to believe this is only the fourth day of trading for 2016, for the new year. And certainly world markets are down. They're down significantly. Germany is almost down 10%. China would be down. Of course, everyone knows about the big drops in the China markets, and we're going to be talking about that here in just a little bit. Before we get on to that, I just want to say, and if we can't touch on this today in 20 minutes, I'm going to make sure we touch on it tomorrow. But, you know, you have so many people out there predicting. You have all these economists. You have all the ones that are on, you know, the conservative side that promote gold and promote their mining shares and promote this and that. And they're always wrong. We talk about their predictions and so forth. Christmas Eve. Lyndon LaRouche. Now, this man is 93 years old, and I don't agree with everything that he talks about. But he had a message Christmas Eve, and it was an emergency Christmas Eve. It was January 1st is doomsday. January 1st is doomsday. And he sent out this special release, and he talks about the transatlantic financial system, how that is about to blow. He says in the past few weeks, now we're talking about the end of 2015, in the past few weeks, $15 billion in junk and investment-grade bonds have been wiped out. We talked about those junk bonds going belly up. And he talks about this being a harbinger of an imminent of a total crash. He talks about $72 billion debt bubble is set to explode in Puerto Rico. Well, we know they were unable to meet a debt payment here just a few days ago. You have an estimated $5 trillion in debt that is tied to the collapsing U.S. domestic shale oil and gas sector that is blowing up. I think that is the biggest threat right now, because you're going to have a lot of those derivatives, you know, the quadrillion, and half of those are going to be tied, maybe not half of those, but a large portion of those that are tied to that gas sector. You have bankings and so forth. We talked about how their reserves had to be increased. Western Europe, he talked about that bubble. He talked January 1, 2016, in Europe, new laws were going into effect, eliminating all protections for bank depositors who will have their savings stolen under the bail-in regulations that has already happened in Cyprus. What did I say? Germany is down almost 10%. More than 10,000 Italian depositors had their savings bailed in the collapse of four banks this December. So, you know, this guy, their research department is probably the best that there is. And the man is 93 years old, and he was the only one that I know, and I read a lot, and I know what my predictions are, and he's the only one that really had it spot on. So kudos to Lyndon LaRouche, and so 93 years old, I guess experience does give you a certain perspective on things. But let's go ahead and get right to the markets today. Another good day in gold. Hey, as long as gold goes up, I don't care. Let the stock market go from 18,000 to 2. I don't care. You know, I like to see gold hold on and go up, in which we had today. You have gold up. And I'm sorry for you listeners out there who have shares. And better get protected. That's all I can say for you, because this is not over. Is it the big drop? We're going to have to see how this folds out here in the next couple of weeks, but certainly 2016 will be a volatile year. You have gold up $15 today at $11.09. You have silver up 31 cents today at $14.40. Platinum was up 2 at $882, and palladium was down 17 at $493. And, of course, again, I think you have a lot of the industrial metals, platinum and palladium, and in some parts silver. I think that's why silver has had such a hard time getting to take off. They were just tied. The whole sector, the whole commodity sector was together. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. You were beginning to see gold and silver break away from platinum and palladium. Eventually, you will see platinum break away from palladium. And I think palladium still has designs to go downward, but I think the three precious metals will continue to go up, of course. The USDX today was down 0.95 at 98.27. Crude oil down 6.9 at 33.28. And, of course, before we start talking about China, I'll tell you what the U.S. did. The indices did. The Dow was down 392 points at 16,514. That was off the low of the day. The NASDAQ down 146 points, down a little over 3% at 46.89. The S&P was down 47 at 19.43, down 2.33%. The 10-year yield still around that 2.15%. The euro did climb big today, climbed a lot bigger than the dollar. And I think this is what you're going to see, too. You're going to see a lot of these other currencies that were going down. I think you're going to see them strengthen, and you're going to see pressure on the dollar. It's just the way it works, and it's the way it's planned. It's not the way it works. It's the way it is planned, and you cannot forget that. So the euro was up 109 it was up 1.47 at 109. And again, Germany was down 2.25%. Hong Kong was down over 3%, and we see the same thing for London, down 2%. And let's see if I have any other interesting. Some of the sectors, of course, the precious metals equity fund, that was a big. Let's see. Well, let's get right into China. So a good day in gold, a good week for gold, and a terrible day for the paper markets. Is this the end? No, it is not. Trading halted for the China stock market after, again, their index fell 7% a half hour into trading. In fact, the amount of minutes that the market actually traded was about 10 or 11 minutes. When it opened, it dropped. They had a shorter circuit breaker that was introduced. Then when that opened, it immediately went down to the numbers, and the circuit breaker for that 7% was introduced and closed for the day. It's the week's second day-long suspension after a plunge in prices that came on Monday, and they had the circuit breakers were introduced on January 1st. If you look at their stock market, it had doubled between 2014 and June of last year before it took the big dive of 30%. And the China stock market is supported by a, or was supported in June when it took that dive of 30%, by a multi-billion dollar government intervention. That market rose almost 25% in the final months of 2015. And again, we only see it collapse in this new year. The main index is down 15% from its December peak. Their stock market gains were not funded by fundamentals. You know, we've seen the turmoil in China that's triggered a sell-off in Asia, Western stocks. Beijing keeps its markets sealed off from global capital flows. But you have to look at China's, the vast size of their economy. Foreign investors watch very closely, and they also react very volatile. They're very volatile. Government had plans to use their stock market as a tool to make China's state-dominated economy more competitive and productive. They wanted, you know, they wanted these, you know, back in June after it collapsed, they wanted new investors into the market. You know, they encouraged novice investors to go into their stocks. They wanted investors to have this money to pay down and to invest for their retirements, for their pension plans, for their health care. It's like it doesn't work that way. That's what they had hoped, that they would get these novice investors in there that would help families save for retirement, trying to ease a little bit of pressure on Beijing that pays, you know, for their pensions and health care at this point. And those plans went wrong when the market soared faster than what Beijing had wanted. But hey, I mean, that's the ultimate sucker rally, I guess. You get all these suckers into the market to think that they're, you know, doing something good. They're doing what their government leaders are telling them to do. And this is how it works out for them. Yesterday, Al shared with you Richard Fisher's statements relating to the decisions of the Federal Reserve, and that what is happening has no relation to China at all. But what is happening to China and affecting the rest of the world is also due more to the policies of the Federal Reserve, and not just since the Great Recession of 2008. I mean, look at all the Greenspan's decisions with lowering rates. Look at the creating the boom of the 90s and the two-year recession coming out of 87 and 89. Yeah, we did have a little bit of Asian contagion in the 90s, but a lot of China's growth stems from those decisions of Greenspan and the coziness of the Clintons and with all their trade agreements in the 90s. So we did help China grow. Would China be in this trouble if all of the extraordinary fiscal and monetary stimulus was produced, or that was produced by the U.S. government? You know, they'd be in their, you know, they certainly would be in their troubles, but would the bubble be as great as it would be? Would our markets be as great as they would be if they would have kept the U.S. government out of these markets and let things be? It is just not the contagion that is circling the globe. It is I believe it's the reality that these world economies have only functioned by the generosity of central banks. You know, China didn't create their growth through brilliance. Their growth was created by the United States. It was Americans who lusted after China's cheap trinkets that allowed our inflation to be exported. And with the trade agreements, increasing their industrial base, providing jobs to all. So their problems, a lot of their problems have been created by the globalization, you know, that has been in the forefront of the United States agenda, that is messing up the whole world's markets. And look what's happening to the people that have their money, the retirement, invested in there. You know, and I wonder how many of these pension plans and these hedge funds, I mean, how much of that money is in these foreign markets? I mean, their money went over there because our dollar was getting too strong. If you look at China's growth in their markets, and you'll see the correlation with the strength of the U.S. dollar. So now China's going to have to deal with their rural workers. You know, they moved to the cities to find work. And now you're having the GDP that is growing, and the jobs are seeming to evaporate. You know, tomorrow our job report comes out. Everybody's looking for about a 200,000 creation of jobs. You know, well, when is our oil industry, those loss of jobs, the impact from that market, when are we going to see the numbers coming out of that? I don't think the number tomorrow is going to be as jolly as everyone is predicting. And, you know, perhaps it won't be tomorrow. Maybe they will get their 200,000. But I think come February or March, I don't believe you'll see those types of numbers. But the Federal Reserve is going to come out and say, well, you know what, those numbers, you know, we wanted to cool off our economy. You know, I mean, it's just bizarre of what is going on. And folks, you know, I can't stress enough and how important it is to preserve your purchasing power and understand gold and silver as what it really does, the true fundamentals. You know, it's just not silver going to, you know, $600 as there's predictions that it will. That's not what it's all about. It's not about gold going to $5,000 and $10,000. Hey, that's great. But you have to remember that all things are relative. And I do believe we're going to see these higher numbers. And, you know, hey, predictions of gold, $50,000, hey, let it come. But understand the reasons why you buy gold and silver. Understand how it provides to protect your purchasing power. Understand that there will be millions and billions, well, not millions, but billions of dollars coming into the gold and silver market. They will be chasing all of that gold product. And that's why when we talk about there will not be product available, I think at any price for a very long time, because there will be so much money chasing gold. There isn't enough of it to sell to fulfill those orders that are coming. And I do believe when gold pops, it's going to pop, and it's going to pop big, and you won't ever be able to catch up and think that there's going to be a day where it's going to drop back that you could take advantage of a lower price. Review your portfolio. Where are you at? How much paper are you holding versus gold? And just because you own gold paper, just because you own gold mining shares, just because you own gold certificates in some country, or just because you have some, you know, account over in Shanghai or Hong Kong or wherever, doesn't mean that you're protected. I think when all markets in these global markets freeze, they're all going to freeze. You will not be able to get your money back. You will not be able to sell your certificate and hope you get delivery of your product. I don't understand how anybody could even recommend only 5% of physical metal in a portfolio. They have to be insane. Very unaware, very uneducated, very misinformed if people tell you to put 5% of your assets in physical metal. That is wrong. And you should take a view of your portfolio, look at it, how much paper you have, how many mining shares do you have, how is your money working for you? Get it protected. If you want to stay in the paper market, that's okay, but get it protected. Insure it. That way, when you have days like today, if you have days like this week, you don't have to worry about it. You know, you look, you can feel confident, you can feel safe. And you can say, I did a great job. I'm protected. Yeah, I still have my pension plan. I can't get access to my funds. You know, so I might still lose money there, but I insured it with gold. So as that teeter-totter fluctuates, you know, you'll be protected. So if you have $100,000 in paper, you should have $100,000 in gold and silver. 80% gold, 20% silver. And that's a rule of thumb to follow. I have many people that are 100% vested in silver, and I have people that are 100% vested in gold. And I have some 50-50. You have to get what's suitable for you. There is no direct There is no one single thing that everyone should do except get gold and silver. 1-800-375-4188. I'm out of time. I hope the boys were able to notice that the markets were falling last night when they were doing the program. So Alfred and James Corbett will be joining you right after these short commercials.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herb's emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. AVR and AVR2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Frank, the producer, he doesn't let me know that the guest is here until about 20 seconds at most before we start the program or start the segment. And that gets me talking to myself. It's like a constant, it's the perils of Pauline. That's where we're, I seem to be caught on the railroad tracks or going over the cliff. And just then, at the last minute, we are saved, and our guest, James Corbett, is arrived. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Good to talk to you again. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. How was your Christmas?
It was very restful, very nice. Got to spend some quality time with my family, but there's a lot of stuff to cover this year, so I'm right back into it.
Let me ask you one question before we get into it. Is it more fun to be a kid who gets toys? You've got a son who's, what, 2 years old now?
2.5, yeah.
2.5. Is it more fun to be the kid who gets the toys at Christmas, or is it more fun to be the parent who's able to buy the toys for the kid?
I think the jury's still out on that one. He's still too young to really get the concept. He kind of understands something's going on, but not quite yet. But I guess by the time he gets a little bit older and looks forward to it, I'm pretty sure that'll be better than my own memories of Christmas morning.
All right. You apparently, I've got a bunch of stuff we could talk about. You apparently have things you want to talk about. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what you think we need to know?
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware I did. Well, I always have.
Well, you said there's a bunch of stuff you wanted to get into.
Oh, so I see. Right. Yes. Yes. Easy. I was just talking generally. But yes, I mean, I guess if we're looking ahead to the year coming, there's so much on the table this year that I think is coming to a head one way or another. And unfortunately, I see a lot of disturbing trends and forces that are developing. And I'm going to be writing about that in my International Forecaster editorial this weekend. But I mean, again, no matter where you look, politically, economically, geopolitically, militarily, even socially, I think there's going to be a lot of things at play this year, and trends that have been developing for some years. But I think they're going to really come to a head one way or another. And obviously, some of the overarching narratives that we're looking at is the road to World War III is one way of framing it. The development and continuation of the new Cold War with Russia and the ongoing tensions with China and all of that. But I think we're probably going to see the next phase of that coming in this year, as the nexus will probably, I'm imagining, will shift from Syria to Iran. I think that's next on the chopping block. And economically, we're at the end of a 7-year bull run in the stock markets, which of course we know is phony baloney bull run fed by the blowing up of the equities bubble. So I think that is coming to an end one way or another this year. And that does not portend well for anyone on the planet, I think. And we've just gotten a taste of that in this first trading week of the new year with the stock indices across the globe, every single major stock index in the world falling in recent days on the back of bad Chinese manufacturing data, bad U.S. manufacturing data, the Chinese devaluation, the oil route, all of these things combining right now to start the bubble popping. So that's something we have to keep our eye on. And perhaps
just before you got here in the first segment of the program, whenever I was talking about an article written by Richard Fisher, former president of the Dallas Federal Reserve. And he said, don't be blaming China for this. So everybody wants to blame China for the recent fall in the markets. What he flat out admitted, he used terms like the Federal Reserve juiced the markets. And he said, the easy money is gone. Won't be here anymore. He admitted flat out that the Federal Reserve has been artificially stimulating the markets for the last 7 years or so, and that's done. They can't. They're not going to be there to support the markets anymore. And that, he says, is the reason that this thing is going down. They can't support it anymore.
I'm sorry. One more time. Who did you say that was?
Richard Fisher.
Richard Fisher. Okay.
Yeah. Former head of the former president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it was a really, people like myself can speculate on things like that, and people may pay attention and may not. But when Richard Fisher talks about this, there's a good chance that he's telling the truth and he's just warning people. I don't know if he's speaking on behalf of the Federal Reserve. He's no longer associated with them directly, officially. Maybe he's writing for them, maybe not. Maybe he's a little bit aggravated that he got bounced out last year. Maybe he was forced out and is saying, all right, I'll get you guys. I'll expose the racket. Now, I don't know what's happening, but still, it's a remarkable document from Mr. Fisher. So he's saying,
well, from what I understand, people serve set terms as Federal Reserve directors of various the reserve banks. So I don't think as far as I know, he wasn't forced out or anything of that.
No,
sort.
I never heard that either. I never heard that either. But you don't know just because. Oh, I'm.
Right. Well, if we're talking about ex-Fed people saying things of this sort, I mean, we shouldn't neglect also Greenspan has made comments like this on multiple occasions in the last couple of years, talking about mm-hmm. how there has been a QE bubble and how there's no way to deflate it without popping it. And he should know because he blew a couple of big ones himself. And set up the subprime bubble as well. So, it's interesting always when Fed people speak out of turn, and there's always the question to what extent it's really out of turn and how much is being sort of allowed or put into the markets in one way or another, put into that mentality. But I think lowered expectations for 2016 is the year all around, economically speaking, is what everyone is looking for, economically speaking, right now. I haven't seen an optimistic prognosis for the year ahead,
no.
Although most of the mainstream commentators at this point are still saying there will be slight growth in the U.S. this year, but not as big as we were hoping because of, you know, the general international economic headwinds.
I wonder, you know, I mean, lowered expectations is a polite term. But is that what we're really facing right now, or are we facing people are saying, oh, my gosh, the stuff is about to hit the fan? In other words, they don't have lowered expectations. They're anticipating some very serious trouble.
Well, I'm anticipating some very serious trouble, and it's because there is a convergence of things. I mean, it's not just the end of the bull run, which will be the popping of the equities bubble and the bond bubble and the housing bubble, which are dominoes within that. But also, when you combine that with the fact that we're experiencing the changeover in the White House in November, I personally don't put a lot of stock and faith in the presidential system and the elections and whether that really changes fundamentally the policies of the shadow government that always rules from behind the scenes. But nevertheless, it is always a time of political and social discord, and different agendas are rolled out. And let's not forget what happened in the last changeover from Bush to Obama. It was exactly in that crucial election cycle window that we saw the collapse, the bailout, being supported, of course, by both Obama and McCain, both mouthpieces for Wall Street equally. And we saw all of that. So it does tend to be a politically, economically, socially, even geopolitically tenuous time at the best of times. And I think given all of the headwinds we are facing, that really does put a lot of emphasis on this, especially this going into this fall of 2016. September is often the time in which there's a lot of economic reckoning, a lot of stock collapses tend to happen in that time frame, and that coincides with the election cycle. I don't know. I just see a lot of things converging towards the end of this year.
Well, I think part of the reason that you see those collapse, or at least these declines in a presidential election year, is that particularly if it's the last, the eighth year of two terms, let's have the collapse now. We can blame it all on Obama, and Congress
exactly.
can start fresh,
yes.
and the new president can start fresh in 2016,
yes.
or
yes.
2017.
Yes. And same with Clinton Bush. Let's not forget that was the popping of the NASDAQ bubble.
The next question, though, is can we afford to pop any bubbles right now? Are we so vulnerable that we don't dare pop any bubbles? We want maybe the people in positions of power, we got to pop the bubble, but can we? Are we too fragile to afford it?
Well, we're going to find out one way or another. There are people who I'm sure would argue that the system can always do that by just creating another bigger bubble underneath it. And the Krugmans of the world, the Keynesians out there, will argue that, you know, all we need is enough government spending and it'll make everything better. I tend to not be in that camp. But hey, I mean, they'll argue that the 2008 collapse was a success because it didn't turn into a collapse of the global economic system. It turned into this 7-year bull run, this incredible rise in the stock market.
Stocks,
hey, everything's peachy.
Yeah, and stocks.
Yeah,
but it
stocks,
wasn't exactly
equities,
a bull
right.
run for the American economy. It wasn't
Certainly
a bull
isn't.
Run for the middle class. It was a bull
nope.
run for the stock markets. And, you know, now we have to get back perhaps to the real world. And how is that going to work out? It's going to be a surprise. You'd mentioned Iran earlier in the program, and people may have seen that here's an article from The Washington Times. It says Iran missile bunker revelation, latest blow to Obama's regional hopes. Iran's leaders on Tuesday revealed the existence of a previously undisclosed weapons bunker stocked with ballistic missiles. The weapons bunker is also the latest provocation by Iran since the much-touted signing of the nuclear deal last summer. Provocations have provided more ammunition to critics both at home and the Middle East, who say President Obama's outreach has done nothing to curb Iran's aggressive policies and so on. Obama's trying to be buddies. He doesn't want to jump in the middle of this thing. He's trying to be buddies with both the Shiites and the Sunnis, both the Iranians and the Saudi Arabians. Is that possible? Can you be pals with both sides of the of that sectarian divide in the Muslim world?
Not without a great degree of geopolitical acumen, which I don't think anyone would accuse of the current State Department of having. So, no, there is. I don't think there's a really well thought out strategy here. I think it's going from fire to fire. But unfortunately, they're not fighting the fires so much as they are lighting them. So I think that's the real key of the problem. I don't think there's any real question as to which side the U.S. is ultimately on here. I think that they are quite firmly supporting the Saudis over Iran. I mean, if it's a question between the two, despite what, of course, plays into the left-right political game, talking about how Obama has really, you know, caved to the Iranians and all of this. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of rhetoric. But certainly, whoever is coming next will probably be much more hardline on Iran. So I guess, comparatively, I guess Obama has been somewhat lax in that regard, if that's seen as a problem. But no, I mean, I don't think fundamentally the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi is ever going to be disrupted by some sort of relationship between U.S. and Iran. Given all things being equal, as we've talked about before, of course, there is a change that is taking place in U.S.-Saudi relations that has to do with Saudi Arabia moving away from that U.S. military umbrella. But at this point in time, I don't think there's any question that U.S. is still firmly in the Saudi camp in the Middle East.
There's an article from the Washington Examiner entitled "White House Refuses to Explain Delay in Iran Sanctions." And they are talking about there's a delay in sanctioning Iran for its illegal ballistic missile tests. They've done it twice, apparently violated UN agreements on two occasions by testing ballistic missiles. Ultimately, this is White House spokesman Josh Earnest said on Monday, "Ultimately, we will impose those financial penalties. We're not going to do it now, you understand. But he says, ultimately, we'll impose those financial penalties. We'll impose those sanctions at a time and place of our choosing and when our experts believe they will have maximum impact." Well, to paraphrase Martin Luther King Jr., is it true that sanctions denied or delayed are sanctions denied? Does the U.S. really have any control or sanctioning power over Iran?
Well, the evidence
suggests that Iran is just saying, "You got nothing on us. We'll do as we please." Is that true?
Given the sanctions regimes they've been under for years now through this nuclear brouhaha, one wonders how much more leverage there really is. And what did that ultimately accomplish? Did it really destabilize the Iranian government?
Nope.
It certainly did not. Quite apparently did not. So I don't really know what is going to be accomplished here other than, of course, scoring political points domestically, which, of course, again, is something that we not only can't downplay ever, but I think certainly can't downplay in an election year when they're obviously pandering for votes with their constituents' bases. So I think this is a lot of political maneuvering. I don't imagine it's going to have a huge effect on the global economy, certainly, and probably not even on the Iranian economy, which has adapted to a lot of these sanctions over the years. And probably, I mean, there's not, again, as I say, there's not a lot of slack in the system for extra sanctions to really have a greater effect than whatever was being accomplished under the nuclear sanctions, which wasn't a lot in the first place.
If I understand correctly, although a nuclear agreement has been reached with Iran, Iran is still being restricted from selling its oil on international markets. If that's correct, what's going to happen when Iran is no longer inhibited and they hit the international markets with what may be 500,000 barrels of oil a day?
I know at the point at which the agreement was being finalized that there were some oil majors, including, I believe, BP, in discussion with the Iranian government, talking about various projects that they wanted to get going, billions of dollars that they would be pouring in to try to develop the various oil and gas fields in Iran. I haven't heard about how that's developed since this point and what sanctions specifically, what order they're being lifted and how soon that's all going to transpire. But yes, I mean, I think there is a lot of extra potential there in the Iranian system that could be coming out, which is not good news for the oil markets, I guess.
No.
If you're looking at oil prices that have just plunged freshly, just in another, I can't remember. Was it 5% plunge? Something in that. 5.
I don't know, but they're down to $33 a barrel. $33.87 change.
It's,
right,
yes.
And they broke 34, which for the first time in something like 11 and a half years. I mean, they're back to where they back prices are back to where they were almost 12 years ago. This is a serious problem. Let's talk about China when we return. I'm Alfred Addisk here with our guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And we will be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Make the aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. An article here from the Associated Press. It says, U.S. Pacific fleet shrinks even as China grows more aggressive. And they're talking about the size of the American fleet in the Pacific is diminishing. And China, again, is allegedly growing more aggressive. Navy says it's not a problem. They have vastly improved technology, and they don't need as many ships as they did in the past. They say this isn't a problem. My question, do you think it's a problem, first off? And do you think China is really growing more aggressive?
I think it's a problem, but not in the way that I think most people would frame that problem. The real problem here is just the growing militarism and the space for that militarism in the South and East China Seas. And basically that is on both sides of this coin. Again, both sides tend to profit and benefit from it, not just monetarily, but of course monetarily as well, from the ongoing threat of tensions. And I think we see that happening right now with China and the South China Sea now flying planes into their artificial island there in that they've constructed in the South China Sea. They're talking about a possible new air, or at least a more real air defense identification zone that they've tried to implement. So, yes, there are things going on there that I guess are, from a nation state perspective, again, they are concerning for various players in the region. But I think ultimately what this just signals is that what we've seen for the last several years is a trend that is going to be continuing, which is the ramping up of resources and tensions. From a military perspective, I mean, still, I've seen various comparisons of U.S. and Chinese forces that use a lot of misleading numbers to try to make it look like it's somewhat of an even match. At this point, it's nowhere even close to an even match. If it was a hot shooting war, there is no doubt that the U.S. would handily be able to defeat the Chinese military. No question about it. And that's even with the technologies and everything that we know above board, let alone whatever they're working on down there in the Skunk Works that hasn't been revealed to the public yet. So even just on its face, there's no question. But again, I guess if you want to maintain a state of tension and people on panicking, or at least in a state of mild fear that justifies more resources and things being devoted to the region, then you have to make it seem like a more fair fight, a more even fight. So I think that might be part of the kind of half-hearted drawdown. But let's look at the larger strategy. Back in 2009, when she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton declared the Asia-Pacific pivot, and that is what the U.S. Defense Department is still working on. Obviously, Syria and things in that region have diverted attention from it, but I think it is still ongoing. And so whatever drawdown in numerical forces we may be seeing, I think we're seeing a lot of other ways that the U.S. is committing to the region in terms of helping with its allies in the region as sort of a proxy conflict that, again, they can use exactly like they use proxy conflicts in Ukraine or Syria or elsewhere to destabilize their political enemies.
Now, when you say proxy conflicts in relation to China, you're implying, at least to me, that somebody else is going to do our fighting with China over in the Pacific. Who would those proxies be, if that's what you mean? Who would those proxies be?
Well, if we are talking about actual armed confrontation, at this point it is a good question, because the only power in this region that can rival or potentially overtake or surpass the Chinese military, I would say, is Japan, is the main serious rival. I mean, obviously, there's always ongoing tensions with Taiwan and Vietnam and Philippines and other players in the South China Sea area that are claiming various parts of that and being more and more made to feel uncomfortable with their holdings in that area. But I think Japan would be, if there is a hot shooting war, I would imagine Japan would be on the front lines of that. So I think that's where the military resources are largely being directed. But of course, there's also South Korea, which is also playing into the proxy conflict with North Korea, because of course everyone knows that North Korea really exists at the behest of China. I mean, without Chinese government support, North Korea would not be able to continue to function. So everyone understands that's a kind of proxy conflict. But then South Korea and South Korea's military forces, of course, backed up by the permanent U.S. military presence there, which makes that type of proxy army in some ways. So there's a lot of puppeteering going on. And again, the Korean Peninsula, as we see, once again, becoming a focus of attention. And that's always a potential flashpoint.
You know, when you talk about puppeteering, there's an article from the Ron Paul Institute. And the headline is, U.S. military leadership resisted Obama's bid for regime change in Syria, Libya. That's the headline. Seymour Hersh's recent revelations about an effort by the U.S. military leadership in 2013 to bolster the Syrian army against jihadist forces in Syria shed important new light on the internal bureaucratic politics surrounding regime change in the U.S. Middle East policy. What he's talking about is that the article pretty much claims that the military, Obama said, we're going to do one thing, And the military said, no, we're not. And they didn't bother talking to Obama. They just said, we're going to support the Syrians. Obama's trying to get rid of them. And the military says, no, we're going to support them. We're going to do what we can to support them. Do you think that's an accurate assessment, all right, of Obama's situation and ability to implement policy in the Middle East and maybe around the world? Is the military really willing to step out and defy the commander-in-chief?
There have been tensions that have bubbled under the surface for a while between various parts of the Obama White House and various members of the military. And, of course, perhaps most notably when we saw, Petraeus that was ultimately outed as having badmouthed Obama, and there was a big brouhaha about that. So I think there are tensions, but in what way did they lie? I have long since passed the point of just taking whatever Seymour Hersh writes from his anonymous unnamed sources at face value. I mean, even if he is a completely 100% on the level guy who's just reporting what he hears, I think there's a lot of manipulation of the info and intel that ultimately gets to sort of journalist insiders like that who get special privileged information. So I take that all with a grain of salt. But I do think that there are tensions between the White House and the Defense Department, between the White House and the State Department, between the State Department and the Defense Department, between them and the intelligence agencies, also within internally within all of these various organizations. The Army and the Navy have different leadership with different ideas. So again, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that this can play out. Does it mean that Obama ultimately couldn't implement some sort of policy if he wanted to? I could only speculate about that, but it just doesn't seem to me to be the defining factor in what's going on in somewhere like Syria, for example. I think, again, that so far has been a almost completely intelligence-led conflict. So the Defense Department's reticence to go in there hasn't really played into it because there hasn't been the political impetus behind that yet. And that's part of the larger wooing of the nation. I mean, you have to convince the public to a certain extent that they want this conflict before the military can be sent in there anyway. So I don't know. I don't think that's the defining part of all of this, but I have no doubt that those types of tensions exist anyway.
Well, we can expect there's tensions in, you know, I doubt if you can find one congressman who agrees 100% with any other congressman, and every president has got to fight battles every day. There are tensions. But what this article by Hersh at least implies is that there are members of the military that refuse to simply salute and execute. President Obama said, do this, and and they said, okay, but they went ahead and they did what they wanted to do instead. That's the implication. And it's an interesting possibility because it suggests that Obama is not well respected, not even, and not just disrespected, but that, you know, people are viewing him with contempt. I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to take orders from that moron. Now, that's a different thing, refusal to take orders. That's different than tensions. It's one thing to call him an idiot. It's another thing to tell him, you know, I'm not doing what you say, or not even tell him, but just go ahead and do what you want and ignore his orders. It raises a question in my mind. If Obamacare is a farce, his signature legislation, and every attempt at gun control only sells more guns, and the military is implementing its own foreign policy contrary to Obama's orders, I'm wondering, were his recent tears a reaction to the deaths of several children, or were they the tears over a failed presidency? He's in his eighth year. He doesn't have long to go. And what else can he do to salvage his reputation? I mean, he's going to be right down there with Jimmy Carter in the history books, at least in most people's opinion. Has it finally reached his mind where he'd like to have a legacy that looked positive? And is he just saying, look, this whole thing's just blown up in my face? Do you think anything to do with his tears, or his tears were just what we, you know?
I think those were well-staged crocodile tears, but regardless of that, I mean, I think clearly, if you are looking for the history books, as I think most presidents would be in the last year of their 8-year term, there's absolutely going to be some calculations about how to the legacy making, And unfortunately, cornered rats are usually the ones that will fight the hardest to get out of the corner. So what do you do? I mean, clearly there's going to be some pretty dramatic moves, and this gun control executive order type of move portends some dramatic things that will be coming in this year. And I think you're right. I mean, I think this is a failed presidency from some perspectives. I mean, clearly the whole hope and change thing was just a soft soap to try to sell the public on basically getting another Wall Street mouthpiece into office. But even from within that framework, I think certainly the Obamaites did not accomplish what they were trying to do in the way that, say, the neocons accomplished what they were trying to do in the first few years of the Bush presidency. So yes, I think that has to weigh on these decisions that are being made right now. And I think that, again, I think that's worrying because, again, a president that's fighting for their legacy in the last year is more likely to do more dramatic things to try to secure that legacy.
We've got probably about 2 minutes left, something like that. Yeah, we've got about 2 minutes left. We talked about China with its man-made islands out in the South China Sea, if I have it. Here's something from the Washington Times, and the headline is, China lands plane on South China Sea, man-made island, in major escalation. They describe this, they landed a civilian plane on a man-made island, a Fury Cross, on a 3,000-foot runway, and they describe this as a major escalation of tensions. But is this really a major escalation or much ado about nothing? I mean, how surprising can it be that they built a 3,000-foot runway and they're describing this as a major escalation of tensions because somebody landed a civilian plane on it? That's what they do with runways. That's what runways are for. I mean, the runway, that might have been a major escalation. So my question is there really a major escalation here, or is the government and or trying to create fear of the sort that you talked about earlier in the program, or is the mainstream media just hyping some trivial event to sell some more newspapers? What do you think?
A little bit of both. But I guess if we have to put some perspective on this, I mean, from the perspective of an empire, which is essentially this 3,000-pound elephant, every single mosquito is potentially this is something we have to go after. We have to make sure this doesn't rise up and become a larger insect that could actually maybe puncture our skin or something of that sort. So from that perspective, I mean, it is kind of ridiculous hyperventilation over something that seemed like a foregone conclusion. But one understands that, again, any potential threat anywhere is a threat to the system itself. So we have to all panic about it. I think really the escalation here is simply the fact that the self-declared air defense identification zone that China has declared around the South China Sea area, which the U.S. has tried to flagrantly flaunt to show that it doesn't exist, is one step closer to actually existing when you start positioning various forces in the area and start using these man-made islands for planes and other military assets. Clearly, that's a step closer to reality. And the more of those types of things that are set up in the region, the more it becomes an on-the-ground reality that would have to be taken out by military force. So the next stage of escalation to try to get rid of something like that would be actual hot military conflict, which, again, I don't think I don't think anyone is really
going to. We're going to have to leave the subject of hot military conflict for another time, James, because we're out of time. I want to thank you, as always, for being on the program. Look forward to talking to you next week. I want to thank you, folks, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbin. Good night.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.